Church believes that the moral act has arranged a test case to prove it. George Reynolds, secretary to Brigham Young and husband of two wives, was designated the defendant. An initial conviction was reversed by the territorial Supreme Court on the grounds that the grand jury which indicted him was illegally constituted. Reynolds was convicted again at a second trial, and this time the territorial Supreme Court affirmed the conviction. He appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The Reynolds case today is generally viewed as the classic, almost archetypal confrontation between government power and religious practice. However, that apparently was not the church's perception at that time. Although it believed the Moral Act to be unconstitutional, it based this belief on general concepts of local autonomy rather than the free exercise grounds of the First Amendment. An inchoate sense of the righteousness of polygamy was undoubtedly a major component of the church's belief that the Moral Act was wrong, but religious freedom was not the thrust of its argument to the Supreme Court. This is made clear by Reynolds' appellate brief. 58 of its 63 pages were devoted to so-called legal technicalities, such as whether the grand jury which indicted Reynolds was legally constituted, whether the testimony of the plural wife at the first trial was properly admitted at the second trial, etc. In the remaining 5 pages, the First Amendment was not mentioned. Instead, Reynolds asserted that the Constitution forbade Congress to enact arbitrary territorial legislation, argued for self-government in the territories, and contended that because he was acting out of religious convictions, he lacked the evil intent or mens rea necessary to sustain a criminal conviction. In ruling on application of the free exercise, therefore, Reynolds resolved an issue that had not been directly raised. Given this fact, it seems surprising that the Supreme Court in Reynolds produced what has become the leading authority on the limits of religious practice under the First Amendment. While there is no direct evidence on point, it appears that the court did so because it found polygamy morally repugnant. Chief Justice Waite, author of the Reynolds decision, was an active Episcopalian who had been a member of the Republican Party since the days when the twin relic first became a party issue. It is not unlikely that he viewed polygamy with disfavor, and indeed in writing to a cleric acquaintance, the justice described his Reynolds opinion as, quote, "my sermon on the religion of polygamy," unquote, adding, "I hope you'll not find it poisoned with heterodoxy." Regardless of his motivations, however, the Chief Justice was undoubtedly deeply interested in the religious questions raised by the trial of George Reynolds. Fully half of his opinion was devoted to an examination of religious freedom under the First Amendment. After disposing of the procedural arguments raised by Reynolds, Justice Waite focused on the religious issue. He stated, and I quote, "The question is raised whether religious belief can be accepted as a justification of an overt act made criminal by the law of the land." Noting that there was no definition of religion in the Constitution, the court tacitly accepted Reynolds' position that polygamy was a religious practice. It then shifted its attention to defining free exercise by referring to the history surrounding the First Amendment's formulation. After discussing the framing of the First Amendment and the ideas of Jefferson concerning its framing, which ideas distinguished the right to religious belief, which was absolute, from religious practice, which could be regulated, the court concluded that, and I quote, "Congress was deprived of all legislative power over mere opinion, but was left free to reach actions which were in violation of social duties or subversive of good order." The court stated that polygamy had always been odious among the northern and western nations of Europe, and noted that under the common law, by statute 1 James 1, it was an offense punishable by death. It pointed out that the same day the Virginia Convention recommended passage of the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, the Virginia legislature enacted the same statute, complete with death penalty. The court then discussed whether polygamy violated social order, such that its practice could be prohibited. It stated that marriage was the most important feature of social life with which government is required to deal. The court referred to contemporary scholarly opinion that polygamy leads to the patriarchal principle, which fetters society in stationary despotism and was therefore destructive to democracy. The court concluded that while government cannot interfere with religious belief or opinion, it may with practices, held that polygamy was subversive of government and offensive to society, and ruled that it was not protected by the First Amendment. The logic of the Reynolds test is ineluctable. Although the right to religious opinion is absolute, the right to religious action may be regulated or even prohibited when it conflicts with non-discriminatory general laws that are designed to preserve social order. To hold otherwise would make social order impossible. Indeed, the Reynolds opinion is in many respects a libertarian one, in that it elevates an absolute status to matters of religious opinion, a status not accorded either religious action or any of the other fundamental rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution. Reynolds has been criticized for creating a belief-action dichotomy that, and I quote, grossly oversimplifies complex issues. If it had held that any religious action could be prohibited, there would be merit to such criticism, as virtually all significant religious beliefs relate to actions of some kind, whether those actions be prayer, attendance at church services, donation of funds, or obedience to a code of personal conduct. However, Reynolds made no such holding. Under Reynolds, an individual is free both to believe as he chooses and to act on those beliefs unless those actions are subversive of good order. This weighing of religious practice against social order was the precursor of the balancing test clearly enunciated in subsequent free exercise cases. Others have criticized Reynolds for its failure to articulate precisely how polygamy was subversive of social order. Justice Waite's reliance on contemporary scholarly opinion that polygamy was inherently antagonistic to democracy would probably be unpersuasive to many today, although his assertion that the traditional family is the bedrock of democratic society would still find support. Indeed, at least one modern Mormon legal scholar has advocated a continuing constitutional preference for the traditional family over alternate intimate associations such as unmarried heterosexual or homosexual couples, due to the importance of the traditional family in transmitting democratic values. The Reynolds decision is certainly consistent with such a position. Although not clearly articulated, a basis for Reynolds' holding that polygamy was subversive of good order is apparent, especially when it is read against the Victorian atmosphere of the times. Implicit in Reynolds' holding was its view that polygamy was immoral. The practice of polygamy, in other words, was thought to be so morally harmful that its practice by a few would be damaging to all society, and thus subversive of good order. By holding the moral acts prohibition, by upholding the moral acts prohibition of polygamy, the Supreme Court was in effect taking constitutional cognizance of legislated morality. Viewed from this perspective, the church's outrage at the Reynolds opinion probably arose not because polygamy was seen as illegal, but because it was seen as immoral. It undoubtedly was painful for a people who, at the command of a prophet, had overcome their own reluctance and practiced polygamy at great personal, emotional, and social sacrifice, only to have decades of public vilification legitimized by the imprimatur of the Constitution. Mormons had accurately criticized the hypocrisy of those, I quote, who brand our wives as prostitutes, children as bastards, while at the same time they themselves are supporters of harlots, unquote, thereby attempting to persuade the public of the relative moral worth of their practice. Reynolds was conclusive evidence that their attempt failed. Is morality a valid basis for legislation? One of the day's most hackneyed cliches, which states that you can't legislate morality, would have us believe that it is not. This aphorism has been invoked as an almost mystical incantation by opponents of laws that reflect underlying social morality, such as prohibition, regulation of drug or alcohol use, regulation of pornography, or prohibition of various sexual practices for commercial or other purposes. However, this cliche and the sentiment it reflects ignores the fact that the law, or at least much of the law, is morality. Law is the morality by which society measures the conduct of its members. Law is the moral code by which society requires its members to live. Law is a reflection of the personal morality of a society's members. In fact, new law often attempts to inculcate new moral sensibilities into society. Thus, criminal laws prohibiting murder, theft, assault, or rape are based on moral judgments that it is wrong to take another human being's life or his property, or to injure that person physically or sexually. Laws prohibiting discrimination in housing, education, employment, or salary are based on moral judgments that it is wrong to deprive a person of a home, an education, a job, or equal pay based upon his or her race, religion, age, or sex. Laws which hold a person liable for his negligence are based on the moral judgment that we are each responsible for our own actions. Tax laws are based on the moral judgment that a person who derives the benefits of a society should be required to contribute monetarily to that society. Even traffic laws embody a moral judgment that it is wrong to endanger the safety of others by driving at excessive speeds or in a hazardous manner. To repeal all laws that have a moral basis because they oversimplify complex moral issues, attempt to impose one's own morality on others, or impose incorrect moral principles would be to render society without law and coincidentally without morality. This is not to say that all law reflects public morality, or that all morality is reflected in law. Some laws are codifications of social policies having little to do with moral values. Conversely, many of society's most important moral values, such as the moral rights of children to be loved by their parents, the moral duty of citizens to better society, etc., are such broad affirmative obligations that they could not be the subject of legal coercion in a democratic society, as the state lacks power to enforce them. Yet, democratic society arguably requires institutionally reliable mediating structures to inculcate such moral values in its members without governmental intervention. Paramount among these structures is the family. By affirming the traditional family against the challenges presented by polygamy, therefore, the Supreme Court in Reynolds not only upheld public morality, but arguably acted to protect society's most important socializing structure. Of course, insofar as it delineates individual rights, the Constitution itself embodies fundamental moral precepts and aspirations of society. This is to be expected of an inspired document. The dilemma often presented in constitutional question cases is the collision of competing moral values. As a group or individual attempts to bring conduct that violates public morality within the greater moral protection of the Constitution. This is what occurred in the Reynolds case. There, the church's practice of plural marriage was viewed as an assault on the traditional family unit idealized in contemporary public morality. The church attempted to overcome the law which reflected that morality by bringing its action within the higher law or morality of the free exercise clause. The Supreme Court's denial of the church's claim to constitutional perfection for polygamy affirmed the preeminence of the traditional family in the face of an alternate associational lifestyle claiming constitutional protection. If the concept of public morality were sufficient to sustain any law that impaired the free exercise of religion, the entire clause would be eviscerated. On what basis, then, may the validity of legislation reflecting moral judgments be evaluated for constitutional purposes? The contemporary Mormon position on this question was set forth by George Q. Cannon in his 1879 review of the Reynolds decision. Critical of Reynolds on several grounds, the thrust of Cannon's argument was that so long as a religious group's belief and practices do not interfere with the rights of others, they should be allowed to act on their beliefs, however nonconformist they might be. Cannon's position was strongly reminiscent of the libertarian principle espoused by John Stuart Mill that, and I quote, "the only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of a civilized community is to prevent harm to others." Modern variants of this argument have been used to support abandonment of laws prohibiting illicit drug use, public nudity, prostitution, pornography, sexual practices between consenting adults, obscenity, or other so-called victimless crimes. The weakness of this argument is that it requires society to demonstrably prove actual harm before immoral activity can be prohibited. This, in effect, allows advocates of nonconformist behavior to shift to society the burden of justifying its traditional values, rather than requiring the nonconformist to demonstrate the benefit, or at least harmlessness, of the conduct he espouses before it receives legal protection. This shifting of the burden of proof creates an intolerable burden on society, as unequivocal proof, or even clear evidence, of the social impact of individual behavior, such as prostitution, pornography, obscenity, etc., is virtually impossible to produce in an objective sense due to the inherent complexities of social interaction and the difficulties in evaluating a particular behavior's effects on society. This difficulty in proving social benefit means that the party that is required to support its position by proof will be the party that loses. Further, this overturning of long-established traditions by shifting the burden of proof takes place not by evidence or even by analysis, but by a simple shift of theoretical assumptions that happens somehow automatically. The demonstrable proof standard advocated by Mills and Cannon is thus unworkable. The only alternative is to allow a legal preference for the traditional moral values contained in legislation that can only be overcome by demonstrable proof of the social harmlessness of the illegal behavior. Reynolds accorded such a preference to monogamy in his decision. Many members of the church today view with dismay the increasing social acceptance of alternative lifestyles such as unmarried heterosexual cohabitation, group marriage, open marriage, homosexual cohabitation, and homosexual marriage, as well as the increasing political and legal acceptance that follows in the wake of this social acceptance. The Reynolds decision, with its recognition of the importance of the traditional family unit and affirmation of long-held moral values, provides the basis for a reasoned denial of constitutional protection to such lifestyles on religious, privacy, or other grounds, holdings which many members today would enthusiastically support. For this reason, the meaning of a reversal of Reynolds should not be misconstrued. If polygamy is reinstated on constitutional grounds, it will be because of a lessening sense of public morality concerning the family, rather than any recognition of the religious sanctity of polygamy within Mormonism. Such a ruling would also mean that other, quote, unrighteous, unquote, lifestyles described above would likely receive constitutional protection because the Supreme Court, unable to distinguish between a sexual and lifestyle practice commanded by God and other such practices entered into for carnal reasons, would apply similar analysis to evaluate each. Thus, though Reynolds versus United States is sometimes thought of within Mormon circles as a victory for evil that prohibited a commandment of God, a reversal of Reynolds today would signify not a return to righteousness, but an increasing public unwillingness to uphold traditional values. The removal of law would reflect a lessened morality. Thank you.
That was excellent. I look forward to the response on that one. Attending a symposium to learn about government is a little like going to the encyclopedia to learn about women. Even if half of what you learn is true, it probably won't help you in real life. If the experience of France and Russia are any guide, things just usually get worse, if anything, when people pay attention to political philosophers. And with philosophers, as with lawyers, you're well advised to take even the facts with a grain of salt. After hearing him deliver a series of expensive lectures on the Swiss Alps, Immanuel Kant students learned that their teacher had never been within 100 miles of Switzerland. I'll tell you right now, I haven't been to Zion, and speculative is about the most generous thing that anyone can say about the conclusions I'll present here. Philosophic papers generally break down into two parts, and this one is no exception. In the first part, the longest, the speaker describes a problem and demonstrates that there's no solution. In the second part, the solution is given. That's in contrast to the Supreme Court opinion, in which the solution is given in the first paragraph and the next 50 pages describe the problem. Here's the problem. Mormons have long-standing commitments to both democracy and theocracy as theories of government. More often than not, early church leaders use the words democracy and theocracy in the same sentence, sometimes combining them with a hyphen into the single word theodemocracy. In the journal History, for example, Joseph Smith proclaimed, "I go for a theodemocracy." And then there are these puzzling statements by Brigham Young. Few, if any, understand what a theocratic government is. In every sense of the word, it is a republican government. Even now, the form of the government of the United States differs but little from the kingdom of God. The kingdom will be a true democratic theocracy. Well, that clears it right up, doesn't it? A person may believe in theocracy and find a long pedigree for his idea. A person may believe in democracy and find that he's in agreement with nearly every living person in this century. But a person who believes in theodemocracy can only be a Mormon because, to my knowledge, no one else has ever thought it up. Since I don't pretend to know what theodemocracy means, it may be helpful to define democracy and theocracy. As I understand it, theocracy is a government in which the citizens acknowledge God as their sovereign and submit to his rule either directly or, as in every instance of which I am aware, through a prophet or a shaman or an oracle or some priestly class, or, in our own example, the Mormon Church in its first presidency. Democracy, on the other hand, is a polity in which sovereignty resides in the people and is exercised by them either directly or through representatives. There are two parts to both definitions: the part which answers the question, who's the sovereign, and the part which answers the question, through whom does the sovereign rule? Theoretically, a country might have the same persons running it under either form of government. I don't intend to insult God's intelligence at all when I say that in theory, if the U.S. were a theocracy, God might appoint Ronald Reagan or Walter Mondale to be president. Conversely, the voters might in theory elect Spencer W. Kimball president this November. They're both about equally likely. The governing person or body isn't necessarily the sovereign. The sovereign is the individual or body the everyday rulers answer to. The ultimate ground of authority in a democracy is the people. In a theocracy, it is God. The fundamental question to ask about any policy is, who is sovereign? With this in mind, it would be well to analyze a couple of familiar entities asking the question, who is sovereign? The fact that the Mormon Church is theocratic and not democratic has always been the most obvious thing in the world to me. From time to time, however, non-Mormons devote long books to proving the fact that we're not democratically operated. And inevitably, articles pop up in response arguing that the law of common consent proves we're a democratic bunch. There is some democratic form to our church, certainly. At least the people are asked to sustain church officers by vote. The preconditions of democracy, participation, discussion, debate, and the sense that individual judgment in the matter ought to be expressed, are all absent from the process. I don't condemn this method of selection at all. It's a perfectly appropriate and effective method of running a church, but it's not democratic by any means. People in the Mormon Church are sometimes shocked to learn that Joseph Smith proposed the release of his counselor Sidney Rigdon in the Nauvoo General Conference and was turned down by the majority vote of the members. Even more unusual in light of present practice is the fact that Rigdon was allowed by the prophet to take the stand in his own defense and try to persuade the members that he shouldn't be canned. Try to imagine this scene or some equivalent of a sacrament meeting or conference session in 1984, and it may help you see that our decisions are not democratically made. During the 1960s and 70s, a majority of church members came to feel that denial of full membership privileges to blacks was embarrassing. Members and missionaries were forever ducking questions on the subject because no good justification of the practice was available, at least none other than God says so. If a vote had been taken in, say, 1975, as to whether the practice should stay or go, I think it would have been overwhelmingly no, it should go. But that's just it. That isn't how our decisions are made. Most Mormons felt and still feel that God should direct the administration of his ordinances and his priesthood. We're glad to say that it's his church. We waited and hoped and some prayed for a policy change. And when it came, there was no canvassing the people on the matter. It was done by revelation. This is not at all to say that church direction is totally unresponsive to members' wishes. An acquaintance of mine, a general authority's son, nearly lost his testimony when a church committee adopted a suggestion he made. He didn't know that God allows participation in the process. If you'll excuse me for this personal reference, but as comforting as it is for me to know that the church belongs to him, there's also something comforting to me as a U.S. citizen to know that the Constitution is ours. As benevolent and effective as theocracy is in Mormon religious practice, a theocratic state has somewhat a chilling ring to it. How ironic. I would rather live under a government administered by the dunces we send to Washington every election than by prophets of the living God. But at least the dunces are mine. They answer to me, and somehow I can bear them because I had a say about which dunces they would be. The bourgeoisie, Mencken called it. The system in which a nation of 200 million, containing at least 2,000 intelligent and able-bodied men and women, chooses Warren Harding to lead. All this and more. And why, do you ask, do I prefer this quadrennial clowning to an enlightened theocratic state? Because the idea of a theocratic state requires two assumptions which I don't assume. The first is that God has the intrinsic, natural right to rule human beings. In Catholic theology, where God is primary or uncreated, and the people are contingent, which is to say created beings, this makes some sense. In our theology, believing as we do that our spirits or intelligences are as old and as eternal and as uncontingent as God, there is less reason to regard God's sovereignty as a given. God has the right to rule me because I promise to obey him. It is the covenant, the baptismal covenant and the others, which create God's sovereignty. But the vast majority of the world has no such covenant with my God, or if they do, in some pre-earth sense, they don't have any awareness of it. Hence, it seems wrong to say that they are under a duty to obey God or the men I hold to be his representatives. I can accept theocratic rule in the church very easily. When I look around on Sunday, I presume everyone over 18 is there because they wish to be, unless they're the speaker. If someone has irreconcilable differences with the church, he or she is free to leave it without changing address or learning a new language. Not so with the government. Moreover, as things stand presently, our church does not and cannot use hard forms of coercion to enforce its rules of conduct. direct economic sanctions, corporal punishment, and execution, all these are rightly refused. But hard coercive measures are the very essence of the criminal law. They are necessary adjuncts to state sovereignty. So much for my own prejudices in favor of popular sovereignty. As for Morgan's commitment to popular sovereignty, you ask, where can it be found except in early expressions about theodemocracy and democratic theocracy? It is well known beyond the need for proof or citation that Mormons accept the U.S. Constitution in a religious and not just an expedient sense. Our scripture tells us that the just and holy principles which find expression in our federal charter belong to people everywhere. A belief in popular sovereignty, the people's right to choose their own form of government, is a direct and ineluctable outcome of agreement with the principles of the U.S. Constitution. Popular sovereignty is the first and great principle of the Constitution on which hangs all the law and the prophets. It is fashionable now to stress that the Constitution is principally a document of individual rights. The charge that the Constitution is undemocratic, which is to say that it expressly limits what government can and cannot do, once taken as a reproach, is now touted as the founder's greatest accomplishment. But in either case, if the charge is that the Constitution is somehow antithetical to the idea of popular sovereignty, then it is false, and its falsity is easily demonstrated. The document, as everyone knows, was ratified by majority vote in special conventions held in each state. No other source of legitimacy is claimed. It does not bind us because it is the best constitution imaginable, or because it guarantees natural rights, or even because God approves it. It derives its legitimacy, as opposed to its wisdom or its benefit, solely from the fact that we the people chose it and have never repudiated it. The people are implicitly the ultimate and sole political authority. Their consent, the deal cut by the sovereign people, is the entire basis for the Constitution's authority to bind us to obey. Without the deal made by the people, the Constitution is somehow antithetical to the idea of popular sovereignty, then it is false, and its falsity is easily demonstrated. The document, as everyone knows, was ratified by majority vote in special conventions held in each state. No other source of legitimacy is claimed. It does not bind us because it is the best constitution imaginable, or because it guarantees natural rights, or even because God approves it. It derives its legitimacy, as opposed to its wisdom or its benefit, solely from the fact that we the people chose it and have never repudiated it. The people are implicitly the ultimate and sole political authority. Their consent, the deal cut by the sovereign people, is the entire basis for the Constitution's authority to bind us to obey. Without the deal made by the people, the Constitution is nothing but parchment. To put it briefly, no deal, no legitimacy. Moreover, in our form of government, the people... ...and the shootout power to throw the rascals out or even change the form of government if it doesn't suit them. Congress is subject to the Constitution. The President is subject to the Constitution. The states are subject to the Constitution. The police are subject to the Constitution. And even lawyers and judges are theoretically subject to the Constitution. But the Constitution is subject to the people, who can alter, amend, or abolish it as they fit. Once a substantial majority is obtained, any provision can be modified, except one which guarantees states equal representation in the Senate. To change that one, the government would have to be dissolved and begun over, I suppose. With the exception of that one solitary covenant pertaining to Senate composition, the U.S. Constitution is a popular document subject to amendment by the people from its first we to the period following its latest amendment. As Chief Justice John Marshall reminded us in Marbury v. Madison, that the people have an original right to establish for their future government such principles as, in their own opinion, shall most conduce to their own happiness, is the basis on which the whole American fabric has been erected. I'm just asserting a simple fact that the Constitution is premised upon the idea of pure and unadulterated popular sovereignty, the right of the people to choose their form of government, with its appended right to rule directly if they choose or indirectly if they prefer. If modern Israel is really committed to the U.S. Constitution, it follows as inevitably as bad weather at conferences,
as embroidering the prayer over the food, is irrevocably a slander that modern Israel must be committed to the idea of popular sovereignty. Now, having done everything I could to convince you that a dilemma exists, I want to forestall three solutions that may have occurred to some of you, but which aren't real solutions. The first is to grant God's legitimate authority in the spiritual realm, but the people's authority in the material realm. If anyone here is a Protestant or a former Protestant, this out will seem most obvious. But it isn't an option within the bounds of Mormon theology. In the first place, Mormon scripture makes clear that spirits and matter are one and the same. Mormons usually distinguish the spiritual from the temporal, things which pertain to eternity as opposed to things which have reference only to this earth. And God did tell us once that at no time has he given a temporal commandment. But he has given commandments about birth control, eating, drinking, driving, storing food, getting enough sleep, going to church, marriage, abortion, dating, sex before marriage, sex after marriage, government, helping the poor, personal hygiene, raising children, and work. If you want to make up a temporal realm excluding these areas and give the people exclusive sovereignty and it's more power to you, just remember, even if you find a topic not already covered, God may preempt it at any time with new revelation. The second false notion is to admit that the temporal and spiritual overlap each other, but while the people as sovereign may exercise coercive power, God is confined to persuasion. This one has a nice sound to it. It suggests a family in which God is the granddad, exerting moral persuasion, and government is a parent, walloping the kids when they go too far. This is just a roundabout way of arriving at popular sovereignty while appearing to cede something to God. But again, this theory runs aground on the shoals of Mormon theology. It would be tedious to recount the dozens of sermons in which general authorities proclaim God's right to control earthly government in the millennial era, and even before then if the chance arises. There are at least five good available historical studies of the Council of 50, the government set up by Joseph Smith and continued by Brigham Young. Prophetic statements abound describing the millennial reign of God's kingdom, with every suggestion that it will be a government distinct from the church and exercising powers we normally associate with governments. Interestingly enough, we're also told that there will be many other religious denominations and a good share of agnostics sprinkled in during the millennium. If such are to be admitted on an equal basis to the new theory of democracy, and if I know my heathens, any arrangement which admits of direct and continuing veto by God of the will of the people will be anathema to this group, unless, and here I'm giving it away, unless God's requirements are reasonable, can be known in advance, and are not subject to modification. The third false escape from the dilemma is to say simply that it's not an issue for now. If God wants to assert his right to rule and reign in the millennium, fine. But now we live under a democracy, and we respect the sovereignty of the people acting via constitutional government. Anyone with such a practical frame of mind can check, clean out his locker and check out at the front desk. This is a theoretical discussion. My solution to the dilemma of popular versus divine sovereignty is to accept them both and join them in a kind of legal relationship which admits of two sovereigns, a simple contract. To explain this solution, it will be necessary to say more definitely what I mean by sovereignty. In European and American usage, sovereignty has reference to dominion over a territory and the society within its boundaries. This combined territorial and social aspect of sovereignty is not the only kind of sovereignty, however. Quite a few North American Indian tribes had a notion of social sovereignty, but not territorial sovereignty. Cherokees and Comanches, for example, as I understand their histories, did not exert permanent exclusive control over any particular territory, except their own camp, which was constantly relocated. Until they took possession of the Promised Land, the Israelites, from what I can gather, have social but not territorial sovereignty. So sovereignty has at least two aspects, and they are separable. Suppose then that men and women of goodwill from every sect and denomination, and even some of the agnostics, could be convinced that God had created or organized the earth as a place of habitation, and that by virtue of said organization or creation, God had the sovereign territorial right to place conditions upon its use by we the people. Without surrendering the notion of popular sovereignty in the social sense, and without further agreement about God's true nature or the best method of worshiping him, we the people might easily be persuaded to enter a contract with the rightful owner of terra firma, particularly if the rightful owner would make his presence and terms known to we the people directly, as he once did when Mount Sinai was all smoke. If the people wish to do themselves hurt, who shall say them nay? As posed by Rousseau, this question is merely rhetorical. Who indeed, except some outside party, such as God, who can contract with we the people? Only a permanent outsider like God could transform this joint enterprise into all the United States into a genuine two-party contract. 20 years ago now, G.E. Mendenhall made a striking discovery about ancient Israel's covenant relationship with God, which not only bolstered the Bible's dating of the Ten Commandments, but showed that the Mosaic covenant, or contract as we might call it now, was really a two-way street. Mendenhall discovered that the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, takes the identical form of a 13th century B.C. Hittite suzerainty treaty. You may have never heard of that word before. A suzerain state is one which has subjugated a neighboring territory and established a permanent relationship of peace with the inhabitants. The suzerainty treaty typically allows the inhabitants freedom to conduct their own affairs and limits them only in those matters which directly affect their relationship with the suzerain. For example, the inhabitants are usually prohibited from entering into treaties or alliances with other states, and from defiling the land and desecrating the suzerain's holy places or gods. On the other hand, the sovereignty of the inhabitants' own government over the social order is not questioned. Mendenhall was the first to see that in the Decalogue, as it is set forth in Exodus, we have a modified copy of the suzerainty treaty. God requires 10 duties which the state of Israel must perform in exchange for the use and benefit of God's territory, his protection, and the relationship of peace. As with the Hittite treaty, the suzerain's territorial sovereignty is acknowledged, but in Israel's case, it is due to God's creation and not his subjugation of the land. Israel's acknowledgement and enforcement of the code becomes the basis of peace and protection which exists between God and Israel. Beyond these 10 duties, Israel is free to conduct its own affairs. In principle, God may not add duties to the contract and must carry out his responsibility of protection. Mendenhall and others see the full Mosaic code detailed at length in the Bible and later commentaries such as the Talmud as an elaboration upon the Decalogue and to a large extent an expression of customary law, which doubtless preceded the Decalogue. The Decalogue, then, is the basis of God's treaty between himself and Israel. Even when Israel radically changes its form of government from the prophet judges to a monarchy in the time of Saul, the covenant is not abrogated, since it does not dictate the form of government. Mendenhall's discovery, apart from helping substantiate the dating of the account in Exodus, suggests that God establishes his covenants with men in forms to which they are already accustomed. If God were to reestablish an earthly government, he might speak to the human race in familiar terms, for example, a constitutional or parliamentary form, containing a bill of particulars requiring the state to do or refrain from certain things and leaving the people's sovereignty intact, thus allowing for government by majoritarian determination. Under this idea, I think democracy and theocracy might be reconciled in a satisfactory fashion.
Before making a comment, I need to explain a dilemma I have. We have really four papers in this session, not just two. Mr. Lee sent me two papers. The shorter one he read exactly as it sent to me, and a much longer and detailed one which supported that, and my comments relate to frequently to the longer, more detailed paper. So we have two papers there, the one you've heard and a much longer and I think better paper, better in the sense that it's more fully developed, that you have not had the opportunity to hear. Mr. Lee sent me a long paper and then delivered quite a different paper here. So I have two papers to deal with there. I like the one he delivered here, I think, much better, although I may have a comment or two to make about that paper, especially the latter comments, but I have prepared remarks. I think they will apply to all four papers, but they are really based on the longer paper by Mr. Lee and the original paper by Mr. Graves. And if you'll bear with me on with that dilemma, we shall proceed. Mormonism has surely come a long way since the Reynolds decision, which can now be enthusiastically supported as a basis for denying constitutional protection to those individuals whose controversial lifestyles us more conventional Mormons now find offensive. 19th century Mormons strongly denounced the Reynolds decision, ignored its demand to cease the practice of polygamy, and did not capitulate on this issue until the High Court dissolved the church in 1890 and declared it a cultus, quote, a cultus rather than a religion. As President John Taylor said at the time, religious faith amounts to nothing unless we are permitted to carry it into effect. The nation's response was that cultist practices are not religion, and therefore beyond the protection of the First Amendment. Contemporary Mormons, having accommodated to the surrounding secular culture for almost a full century, and now among the nation's most conservative citizens, are today among those least likely to engage in alternative lifestyles. If 19th century Mormons were excruciatingly slow in recognizing that open and notorious sexual behavior, which shocks the sensibilities of the whole nation, will not be allowed, whether religiously motivated or not, contemporary Mormons may also be less than fully aware that sexual behavior that no longer shocks the nation will in fact be tolerated and will eventually be sanctioned by law. The point of our discussion today is not whether America should attempt to legislate morality. Morality, including the morality of the Bible, was the basis of all kinds of legislative enactments in early and in contemporary America, as Mr. Lee has demonstrated, and this interconnection will remain strong so long as America remains strongly Christian. For that's the basis of this morality. The point is that the boundaries of what is constitutionally permissible at any given time, whether in the 19th century or today, are decided by the majority of that particular era, coming back to Mr. Graves' idea of popular sovereignty. When the majority wants morality legislated, it will happen. When it is not much interested in legislating morality, as is the case today, little will be done. When Hall has discarded 19th century, quote, logic, unquote, which to his mind was religion-based and syllogistic, in favor of, quote, experience, by which he meant the felt necessities of contemporary social values, he was telling us, Holmes was, that law is simply a manifestation of the dominant beliefs of any given society at any given time. Reynolds, with its belief-action dichotomy, represented the dominant and essentially religious beliefs of the 1870s. That decision is less compelling today and has been modified by Yoder against Wisconsin and other decisions because we are a much more secular society today than we were, all of us, in the 19th century. Turning to Mr. Lee's paper, I am pleased to say that I found it very well focused, well written, thoroughly researched, closely and carefully reasoned, and persuasive on his main point that Reynolds might conceivably be used sometime in the future to deny constitutional protection to alternative lifestyles such as homosexual marriage. Although obviously more knowledgeable and, I think, interested in the contemporary implications of the Reynolds Doctrine, Mr. Lee nevertheless has a good grasp of the historical issues, if not the detail, of the Reynolds era. I was not, however, persuaded by his argument that the logic of Reynolds, of the Reynolds text, is ineluctable. The famous wall of separation concept that the court announced for the first time in Reynolds is both simplistic and more a figure of speech than a reason for doing anything. The Reynolds Wall was very high in 1879 when that decision was handed down. And the Mormons' blatant attempt to sneak around that wall failed. But the Yoder Wall, the Yoder against Wisconsin Wall, the decision handed down just a few years ago, is relatively low. This is where the Old Order Amish were allowed to cite religion as an excuse not to obey a criminal statute in Wisconsin which required the Old Order Amish to send their children to school after the age of 14. They said school corrupts, which it does. Certainly their values. And they didn't want them to go to school. The court said that's fine. The Amish, they said, were a quaint people and didn't bother anyone, so they'd let them do that. So the Yoder Wall is relatively low and allows the more quaint Amish, compared to the more, you supply the term, Mormons, allows the more quaint Amish to amble over this low wall quite easily. More significantly, the Reynolds reasoning is exceedingly eclectic, using some of Thomas Jefferson and Professor Lieber's, one of the court's authorities, language when the court likes what they had to say and ignoring equally important statements by both when they go against the court's announced position. Moreover, inserting the words wall of separation into the First Amendment gives no more clarity to these complex issues than calling the Constitution divinely inspired, as many Americans did at that time and some Mormons do today. Mormons could just as easily have been allowed to practice polygamy in the 1880s as fundamentalists are allowed to do so in the 1980s, right here in the city, provided the public had not been outraged. The problem was that the public was outraged. That fact, and not the eclectic logic of Reynolds, is what decided the case. I am not fully persuaded by Mr. Lee's argument that anyone who wishes to depart from traditional social relationships should always have the burden of proving that his or her lifestyle is essentially harmless to the disapproving majority. Imagine what our intellectual and social standards would be like today if the court had taken that position when it decided whether to allow local authorities to censor the film The Moon is Blue, which used the words pregnant and virginity, which the U.S. Navy and the state of Maryland felt were lewd and lascivious. Would we be reading Ulysses today if the publisher had had to prove beyond reasonable doubt that it was not harmful, that if the book Ulysses was not harmful to the social mores of the 1930s when the decision was handed down? Would married women have a legal right to equal pay for equal work if they had to demonstrate that work outside the home would not adversely affect their children? Far better, in my view, to take a case-by-case approach, like we do with the obscenity issues, with the initiating party assuming the burden of proof and using contemporary community standards, as we do in the obscenity cases, as the ultimate basis of judgment. That way, both the individuals and the community's interest, seems to me, would be better protected. Turning now to Mr. Graves' paper, and this is the paper you haven't heard, but the long paper which I received, he has taken the broadest possible focus in that paper from the pre-existence to the millennium. As with the previous paper, I found this one, Mr. Graves' paper, thoughtful, readable, and on a topic of considerable importance. I shall pass over some of the things which he said in that paper that you have not heard, and come to what some of the things or the implications of the things which you did hear. The Mormon concept of an inspired constitution raises in my mind more problems than it solves. There does not seem to be any demonstrable incidence of divine intervention in either the creation or the ratification of that document. And even if there were, there would be no way for us to really know the inscrutable ways of God, just how he, she, or it happened to intervene, in on what day and in what way. Certainly most of the founders did not believe in divine intervention, and many, like Jefferson, detested metaphysics generally. Also, like Jefferson, most were more interested in public happiness than in celestial bliss. It is true that many of the founders accepted the idea of an innate moral sense implanted in our breasts by nature, not by God, but by nature, says Jefferson, and certain natural rights, which were embodied in, of course, the amendments. But interest groups, more than the common people, played the major role in its ratification. My point here is that I don't think we can examine historically anything that relates to the possibility or the allegation of divine intervention. We simply don't have the tools to deal with that in the historical sense. And without those tools, you couldn't possibly get agreement on what that meant outside your own little particular religious group. And not even a whole religious group would agree on that point. Like Madison, the founders had a more profound distrust of transient majorities than a low view of human nature per se. Democracy, not human wickedness, is what worried them. After all, the Constitution does make the people sovereign, as Mr. Graves has pointed out. That's the greatness of our Constitution. We are responsible. We have the power than which there is none higher. Moreover, the whole process was a series of compromises between those who wanted a confederation and those who wanted a unitary state, those who favored big states and those who favored small, and whether the locus of sovereignty lay at the national or at the state level. To say that the Constitution is inspired in light of all of this history and all of these complexities is to say that providence must delight in ambiguity. And if that's the case, then that's fine, but that doesn't give us much clarity. Nor is the equally vague concept of the rule of law much more helpful as a guiding principle of government. Law does not rule, men do, and now men and women. Laws do not interpret themselves, men do, often with considerable bias and passion. Mr. Graves, I think, rightfully recognizes some of these limitations, and I was impressed with statements and agreed with many of the statements that were being made. But I would go further and agree with Oliver Wendell Holmes that a constitutional right is not much more than a prediction of what courts will do in fact, and that no concrete proposition, including allegedly inspired ones, is self-evident. The principle that those who are governed must give their consent to such government is equally fraught with difficulties. If consent simply means that we consent to the general form of the government that we have, that doesn't mean much. If it means consent to more specific provisions, like, for instance, judicial review, the public has not always been asked. We've never sanctioned that in any specific way. In fact, the court was even reluctant to use it for some 55 or so years after Marshall announced it in 1803 in Marbury. Or if it simply means that the people have the right to be consulted regularly, as we sometimes are at conference, we have little more than the old divine right kings offered their subjects. When a single non-elected, anonymous Supreme Court justice decides an important constitutional issue for a whole generation against the will of legislative majority, both at the state and the national level, can anyone claim that the people have given their consent? This is, of course, precisely what happened in the income tax cases in the 1890s, which required a constitutional amendment to overcome the will of one anonymous Supreme Court justice. We still don't know his name. Examples of this sort, of course, could be multiplied, and those of us who teach constitutional history spend a whole quarter multiplying such examples. The Constitution really means, in the final analysis, what the final five of the August 9 say it means, to quote Learned Hand and to paraphrase Chief Justice Hughes. And worshiping that kind of system, that is, the system whereby the Constitution means what five justices say it means, worshiping that kind of system, however laudatory its results, seems to my mind naive and juvenile in the extreme. Finally, I share Mr. Graves' skepticism regarding the efforts of those who have attempted to make the concept of a divine constitution meaningful. These unspecified, quote, just and holy principles, unquote, allegedly embodied in the Constitution, are as difficult to identify as Herbert Wexler's more modest, quote, neutral principles, unquote, which he tried very laboriously to find in the 1950s and didn't persuade, I think, a single serious scholar to agree with him. The rational and disinterested application of constitutional norms to all comparable controversies, without bias or politics or class interest, by the Supreme Court is very difficult to find in any era. In fact, I would defy, and usually do, challenge my students to find a neutral decision at any time in our history. These alleged principles, whether neutral or holy, have at one time or another sustained slavery, required segregated schools, inconsistently supported both the 19th and the 21st Amendments, and heralded the sanctity of contracts and the abrogation of contracts at different times. These principles have been used to make corporations persons and black persons property. They have been interpreted to require special privileges for businessmen, special burdens for labor, and both laissez-faire and welfare state types of government. They have sustained wartime dictatorship under Lincoln and Wilson, and both broad and narrow standards of morality depending on what the people of the time wanted. In short, and in conclusion, those just and holy principles, whatever they are in theory, are in their actual application, and that's when it matters, because they're being applied to us, just as in the Reynolds case, are largely and simply a mirror of the social values of the day. Now, one more comment I'd like to make about Mr. Gray's paper, which he read, which I found very, very interesting and fascinating, but have not seen before now, in terms of how to reconcile democracy, which makes the people sovereign, and sovereignty means a power than which there is none higher, and the theocracy, which has been practiced, but I don't think is much taken seriously in our church today, except in the doctrine, but not much in the practice, as it was back in the 1900s. I agree that these ideas of trying to solve the dilemma of pauper sovereignty versus the involvement of God, the three he mentioned, you limit God to the spirit and the people to the real world, that God uses persuasion and we can use force, and that God's absent, so we don't concern ourselves much about it, are not very real solutions. The suzerainty solution, where we have two sovereigns, I think, reminds me of the same problem we had prior to the Civil War, where we had two sovereigns, the state and the nation. The locus of sovereignty was not clear. Now, sovereignty really means the power than which there is none higher. That's the meaning of the word. And what we had was an ill-defined sovereignty in the Constitution until the Civil War made it very clear who was sovereign. The nation is sovereign, the states are not sovereign, and the people ultimately as national citizens. Now, the problem then with this divided sovereignty, I think, today is the same kind of problem that we've had in this nation for the first several decades. That is the covenant theology. If God appears and makes a covenant, well and good, if everyone sees and everyone understands God on that occasion, but that has not yet happened. The contractarian approach that Locke used, that people used like James Buchanan to try and get the deficit eradicated, is much talked about, but very little acted upon. And I don't think that, although lawyers are inclined to write contracts, I think the rest of us who are not especially inclined toward contracts, especially in our governmental activities, that would be very appealing. The suzerainty idea of limited sovereignty, and I end with this, I think would be increasingly difficult for the very same reason that we began this discussion, that Reynolds is... The statement that Reynolds makes, namely that in a religious era when people are shocked and their religious sensibilities are shocked and you're essentially announcing blasphemy, if you're advocating polygamy, that will be stopped as it was then. In a secular era as we are today, and I think increasingly so, for better or worse, the idea of a limited sovereignty or a dual sovereignty becomes less and less persuasive because we recognize more and more the here and the now, the temporal, and us as individuals, which isn't so much different from the way Thomas Jefferson thought back when the Constitution was signed. Thank you.
I'd like to thank Mr. Lee, Mr. Graves, and Professor Clayton for their participation, the excellence of their preparation and delivery.